This is the Santita Jackson Show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Santita Jackson Show. It is Friday, September 10th, 2021. I'm Santita Jackson. This is the Santita Jackson Show. We're coming to you from WCPT, the nation's largest progressive talk radio station, and AM 950 radio, the voice of progressive Minnesota. Minnesota, we're going to have one of your homegirls, Colleen Rowley, the FBI whistleblower. We're going to talk with her at the bottom of this hour. We're going to be talking about 9/11. Of course, the 20th anniversary is tomorrow. And there is a documentary, 9/11's Unsettled Dust, that really looks at those first responders who really saw a serious decline in their health. So, I mean, they, in their health collectively, many of them have died of cancer, and so many have struggled. And we have to look at how that happened, how it is that they were pushed back to work without PPEs. Does that sound familiar? Yeah. That's what happened then. It's like we haven't even learned the lesson. So we got to talk about that. I want you to call me at 773-763-9278, 773-763-WCPT. If you want to text me, GWC Injury Lawyers gives you that opportunity. But I want to hear your voices today. Where were you? Where were you when those planes hit those buildings? It changed everything. You couldn't fly in the United States. You couldn't move around for a long time, and we didn't do it safely for a very, very long time. And so I want to know, I want to hear your thoughts. Where were you when the world changed for so many of us, for so many of us? I want to know, where were you? Where were you when those planes crashed? How did you react to that? Because you had to leave downtown. You had to come back home, whatever you were doing. I want to know what happened, how you processed that day. And what are your thoughts 20 years later? Call me at 773-763-9278, 773-763-WCPT. And I want you to meet my morning stars, Dave and Linda and Paula and Andre, and so many of you today, Daphne and Jewel, Michael Ann and Lorraine, Carol from the Left Coast, Shirley from beautiful Philadelphia, Barbara Bacon from out in Oak Park, Daryl. I want to hear what your thoughts are today. I want you to join them over on the Santita Jackson and Friends page on Facebook and on Instagram. Jewel, always thank you for sharing on Twitter at Santita J. She always shares the show. Please, everybody, share it as broadly and widely as you can. The show continues to grow because of your support. And I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart. Try to get a lot of information, and they want you to turn up the volume just a bit, Paul, just a bit, but we don't want it to be too hot so that it clicks, okay, everybody? So let's get to some of these headlines so that we can get to the rest of the show, because we got to get some good news from Pastor Tisha Williams and got to talk about COVID, everybody, and our health. In Chicago, we're going to have a high of 80 degrees. It will be sunny. Minneapolis, St. Paul, a high of 82 degrees, sunny. The Dow closed down 151 points yesterday. The NASDAQ closed down 38 points. The S&P 500 closed down 20 points. And the Twins, well, they fell to Cleveland. Cleveland 4, Twins 1. The Cubs will be facing off against the Giants today. And then, the White Sox fell to the Oakland A's. A's 3, the White Sox 1. Well, President Biden has thrown down the hammer, everybody, cast down the gauntlet, made an about-face from a few months ago when he said that he would not impose COVID-19 mandates, not vaccine mandates. Well, that has changed. He's imposed stringent new vaccine rules on federal workers, large employers, and health care staff in a sweeping attempt to contain the latest surge of COVID-19. He said, quote, "We've been patient, but our patience is wearing thin, and your refusal has cost all of us," close quote, said President Biden, his tone hardening, according to this CNN report, toward Americans who still refuse to get a vaccine. The new requirements could apply to as many as 100 million Americans. Almost two-thirds of Americans, if this is successful, will have gotten the vaccines. What do you think about that? What do you think about getting those shots? At the center of President Biden's new plan is directing the Labor Department to require all businesses with 100 or more employees to ensure their workers are either vaccinated or tested once a week. Companies could face thousands of dollars in fines per employee if they do not comply. Dr. Anthony Fauci said suppressing the virus is the end game to the pandemic, with a reasonable goal to get cases below 10,000 a day as child COVID-19 hospitalizations reach a new high in the U.S. Cuba has begun vaccinating kids as young as 2 years of age. What do you think about that, everybody? Do you agree with it? Call me at 773-763-9278. You just comment on the headlines no matter what. I want to know what you're thinking, because back in December, President Biden said, I don't think we're going to do this, but things have changed. Nearly 18 million Americans last year could not afford prescription medication. Excuse me, that is this year, everybody. Around 15.5 million U.S. adults at the age under the age of 65 and 2.3 million seniors were unable to afford at least one doctor prescribed medication this year. What do you think about that, everybody? As we're mandating shots, are we going to mandate universal single payer health care? What do you think about that? I mean, if we're going to do that, do you think that we should do that? I mean, I think that the pandemic would be rolled out very differently if we all had equal access to equal high quality health care. In the meantime, according to this study, Americans are finding it harder and harder to keep up with their good health. In fact, since the pandemic, according to this new survey, 13,000 people in 24 countries, including 2,000 in the United States, people are trying to get healthier. 82% of the people globally feel currently they're taking steps to improve their health. However, Americans aren't faring as well as the rest of the world. Only a third, 32%, say they're now able to exercise longer without feeling winded, while only 29% have gone down a size or a belt notch over the course of the pandemic. How can we improve healthfulness, everybody? Have you had trouble paying for your prescriptions? Well, I want to hear what your thoughts are, everybody. Call me today at 773-763-9278. Pastor Tisha Williams out there on, well, this is a day that I'm sure you feel quite profoundly, because you are a New Yorker, as I was in 2001. And those of us who lived in New York, certainly, I'm not saying that it happened in New York. It happened literally in our front yards. But yeah, it also happened in Pennsylvania. You had that plane that was taken into the ground in Pennsylvania. You have the Pentagon, which was hit. And then you suspended air. You couldn't catch an airplane in the United States. So really, really, it was quite a moment for all of us. I think everyone has some reminiscence about that day. Just very quickly, your thoughts about September 11th, 20 years later.
Sure. That day is a day that I obviously will never forget. I remember it like it was yesterday. Stephen King, the horror novelist, wrote a book called The Stand, and it was the last days where the stand was against good and evil. And I remember a scene in the TV movie where the streets were completely empty, almost like Will Smith's I Am Legend as well. And people were just walking through empty New York City streets. And you know, Santita, there's no such thing as empty New York City streets. Mm-hmm. But that day, the streets were empty. And I remember walking alone down 6th Avenue with the Empire State Building behind me and the smoke and the dust of the World Trade Center before me. And it was the first time I realized that you could see both buildings, both venues on 6th Avenue as I walked down the middle of the street. It was the most eerie, scary moment in my life as a New Yorker. What was even more frightening was that my husband worked in the building that collapsed right next to the towers at the time. But because he decided to wait for me and said, let's just commute in together, which never happened, because he decided to do that, he was not in that building that day. And so he did still go to work, and I still have the dust covered shoes that he wore that day as he walked through the ash and the bodies and the debris. And I kept them, and they're in storage in plastic because, God forbid, should anything happen to him, his breathing or anything, I wanted to be able to have them test those shoes, because I do know of people who did pass away because they inhaled the dust that day. It was just the most horrific day ever. Imagine not being able to know if he's dead or alive because there's no signal, no connection. And we're both in the heart of the city, him right in the heart of Ground Zero. So just a haunting day. I saw when the second plane hit the towers from the train. The train that I was on was outside and elevated. The first had already hit. At that time, we thought it was just a prank. And then as we're going into the city, I saw the second plane hit the towers, and I just screamed on the plane, and everybody started to look. And the last thing I'll say, the most haunting memory, there was a young girl sitting in front of me on the train, and when we realized what happened, she started to cry very silently. And I said, "Are you okay?" And she said, "No, my mom works in that building."
Oh.
And I often wonder what happened to that young woman. Mm-hmm. And prayed emphatically that her mom made it out that day. But it was certainly one of the most horrific days in my memory. Truly, to this day, I can remember every detail like it was yesterday.
You know, and tragically, people experience a 9/11 all over the world all the time.
And yeah.
My prayer is that this will make us more empathetic.
Sure.
As we think about dropping bombs, as we think about invading a country, as we think about occupying a country. We've experienced that, and we have to remember that. But, well, you know what?
Yeah.
We need some good news before we get to Dr. Deborah Verholden. We need it. We need it today.
Yeah.
Need it.
Well, today, interestingly, I want to talk about less roles.
Mm.
As always, thank you, Santita. From the Gospel of Luke, Jesus had some would-be followers. So as they were going along the road, someone said to him, "I will follow you wherever you go." And Jesus said to him, "Foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." Okay, Santita, it's the same story every Sunday morning, or at least it used to be when we were in the building. I'd wake up first, I'd shower first, I'd dress first, and somehow I was still the last one out of the door. How did this happen? Larry wakes up 30 minutes after me, and somehow he's waiting on me when it's time to go. Well, in my frustration, I decided to assess my activities in an effort to ascertain exactly where I go wrong. And here's what I found. I found that preparation was not my problem. It's all the piddling I did. Southern people know what that is, piddling. All the unfinished business that made the difference between me being prepared and being ready. And there is a difference. I know I'm not the only one. You're prepared to walk out the door. Wait, is the iron off? You're all set to leave the house. Oh, my gosh, do I have my keys? You're equipped with everything. But here's the most recent one. Where is my mask? I ought to have a witness. Where are my glasses? Did I take my medicine? Is it raining? Is that a run in my stockings? Did I feed the dog? And the list goes on and on. If I'm talking to you today, Facebook say amen. And after all of this, I've blown my 30-minute head start while Larry stands at the door, keys in hands, and says, "Let's roll." Now, if anybody ever says this to you, you know there's a certain level of intensity implied in that phrase. That means they're ready to move, they're ready to attack, and they're ready to go and should not be kept waiting. And in this text this morning, we find out that it's one thing to push people's patience, it's another to push Jesus's. And here we find a subject that's satisfied to do just that. Jesus encounters many people who want to serve him. And our text deals with one today in particular, and who has their own set of deterrents that delay them from rolling with Jesus. And this first man wasn't ready to rough it. That's what you have to ask yourself today. Are you ready to rough it? Jesus took one look at this guy and said, "You are not ready to roll with me." Because oftentimes rolling with Jesus means roughing it. I'll give you this example. I love camping in my backyard. For all the girly stuff I love to do and dress up and makeup, I love camping in my backyard. I will pitch a tent, build a fire, gather my provisions, and sleep outside for days at a time. It's peaceful. It's quiet. I love stargazing. I love looking at the moon. It is my happy place. And so many people ask me, "Aren't you cold? Aren't you afraid? Aren't you uncomfortable?" My answer to all those questions is no. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm no Bear Grylls. Let me be clear. I've got an alternative. Should I hear something scurrying around, or should the temperature drop to freezing, or should my body begin to hurt from the hardness of the ground? I can go home. You see, I'm in my tent, but I'm not trapped there. That's a word for somebody today. Some of you have pitched something that you think you're trapped in, but God is telling you today you're in it, but you're not trapped there. Because not 50 feet away is access to safety, warmth, and comfort. I can go home. And knowing that my time in this tent is temporary is what makes it tolerable. And Jesus was making it clear to this man that following him had the potential to be frightening, cold, and often uncomfortable, especially for those used to luxury. This man was a scribe. He was an elected official, sort of what we would think of today or how we regard a politician, a position that comes with a certain level of comfort. So imagine being a politician once revered, now reduced to roughing it. Maybe we could ask Judicial Circuit Court Circuit District Attorney Jackie Johnson, who was indicted last week for violating her oath of office and hindering a law enforcement officer following the Ahmaud Arbery murder. Maybe we can ask her what it feels like to be revered and now roughing it. And to illustrate this point, Jesus gives a discourse on the habits of foxes and fowls and says he has no place to lay his head. I want you to know today that might seem scary, but there's not a person in the Bible, Old Testament or New, that didn't suffer some discomfort in following God. Sometimes we expect a life free from trouble, but on the contrary, he promised there will be trouble. But here's what else he promised, and I will be with you always. I will never leave you. This is the great thing about following Jesus. It's really not scary because he says, all that were put in my hands, I have lost none. You don't have to worry about safety, and you really don't have to worry about elevation because he says, what is man that thou art mindful of him? The son of man that you care for him, you made him a little lower than the angels. What? That's God's idea of roughing it, y'all, making you a little lower than an angel. So if you can give up man's glory for God's glory, somebody say today, Lord, let's roll. And as we commemorate the 20-year anniversary of September 11th, I'm reminded of Todd Beamer, a passenger on United Flight 93 that was hijacked. He placed the call and got to supervisor Lisa Jefferson. He reported that one passenger was killed and later that a flight attendant had told him the pilot and co-pilot had been forced from the cockpit and may have been wounded. He was on the phone and said that it made a turn in a southeasterly direction, a move that had him panicking. He told the operator that some of the plane's passengers were planning to attack the hijackers and take control of the aircraft. According to Jefferson, Beamer's last audible words were, "Are you ready, guys? Let's roll." This term would later become the war cry for those fighting Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. We could all take a lesson from Todd Beamer today. Exposed and in danger, when it was time to move, Todd Beamer was ready to roll. And I'm telling you today, God, Jesus, our communities, our people are looking for that same commitment for you and me. And guess what? We're not expecting anything from you that we wouldn't do. Jesus is not expecting anything from us that he didn't do. Let's roll.
Amen. Let's roll. And let's make this world a better place because we can. Yes, Pastor Tisha Williams, stay right there. We've got Dr. Deborah Verholden. I wish we'd keep you on longer today, Dr. Deborah Verholden. But, you know, we're talking about September 11th and really going over what we knew then and what we know now, 20 years later. But something seismic happened yesterday. President Biden casts down the gauntlet. Businesses that have more than 100, that have 100 employees or more, got to get everybody vaccinated or if you're not vaccinated, you're going to have to be tested. I'm wondering if employees are going to have to pay for those tests. That would be very interesting. What do you make of this?
Well, good morning. It's interesting because a lot of the things that are being done, they're just not equity focused. They're not equity centered. I don't consider these so much bold moves as I just consider them to be moves. Like, what's the logic behind that? Right? What's the real logic behind that? You know, how does that decision do anything other than have the potential to get numbers up? But what it's going to do is potentially just widen gaps that already exist. I've been very clear with people. I am not opposed to a vaccine mandate. I'm not. But it needs to be universal. I'm not opposed to a mask mandate, but it needs to be universal. What's so crazy? They have they're mandating vaccines in certain places for certain police forces, for school teachers. The CDC don't have that stuff. The CDC themselves is not required that their own employees be vaccinated, that they wear a mask every day when they're on campus. I mean, so it just seems strange. We, to this day, have never had a national mask mandate. So I don't know. These just don't feel like well-informed decisions. I feel like they're all just sitting around making up stuff. It's like, where is good public health? Where is the science of health behavior change? Where are the communications and the marketing experts? You know, like they just haven't engaged experts in any of this. And so now he's just wielding his power. I think, and he made some other statements about the unvaccinated and blaming them on this COVID surge. And most of us can understand and appreciate it's more nuanced than that. And continuing that narrative is only further alienating people. And I think a lot of the people who are no are now digging their heels in even harder to stand in that no. So I don't think this is good public policy. And I don't think that this is a very informed strategy that he's using. That's my 2 cents.
Well, no, it's more than 2 cents because, we're going to have to continue to tease out this conversation next week. We really need to look at this because I think that you're right. It's going to make people dig in their heels. And we have culture wars with this already. And look, anytime you have to get on, if you're on an international flight, even when you've been vaccinated, you have to carry proof that you are COVID-19 negative. Because these breakthrough viruses are not 1 in 5,000 or 1 in a million, as we heard sometime before. It's happening a lot. So, you know, really, you need to find out if people are COVID-19 negative, Dr. Deb. I've got 30 seconds. Help me. If I'm wrong, help me, because I'm not the scientist here. You are.
Well, and even when, you know, so I will say this. If people are vaccinated, the potential for you to recover and how your body will respond to COVID, you're giving yourself the best fighting chance. So I do ultimately believe that the vaccine is in people's best interest. But it's not the end-all, be-all. It's not. It is not the end-all, be-all, and it is not going to, by itself, stop or prevent the spread of COVID. And we know that. We need to be honest about that. We need to be honest about what it does provide and let people make the choice. And
you know what? Next week,
mandate, then it just needs to be universal. Just make it a universal mandate, and then we have to do the work to get the shots in everybody's arms. In the absence of that, we're just creating more problems and poking bears.
Well, everybody, you know what? Why don't we mandate a health equal access to equal high quality health care for all, Medicare for all? Why don't we do that? I want that mandate. Let's start there, because then you could roll all this stuff out if you guarantee that we don't have to go into bankruptcy to be well. Back with more of the Santita Jackson Show in a minute. Colleen Rowley, the FBI whistleblower, who said we ignored warnings about 9/11. This could have been avoided. Back in just a minute.
We can change the world. Change the world. Change the world.
Oh, yes, we can.
We can change the world. We can change the world. Change the world.
This is the Santita Jackson Show.
September 11th, everybody, 2001. It's been 20 years tomorrow since that awful, awful day where we saw the attacks on the World Trade Center in New York, when we saw the attack on the Pentagon that was headed to the White House, where we saw another plane that was heading to Washington, D.C., and the passengers overtook the plane, sacrificed their lives so that we would not endure any more attacks. What do you think about September 11th? What did we know then? What do we do? What do we know now? How has it changed how we live? I'm Santita Jackson. This is the Santita Jackson Show, WCPT 820, the nation's largest progressive talk radio station, and AM 950 radio, the voice of progressive Minnesota. I want to hear your voices today, 773-763-9565. 973-763-9278. That's WCPT. If you want to send me a text, go there, and GWC Injury Lawyers will afford you that opportunity. Hey, Carissa, up in Minnesota. And so I want to hear your thoughts today about September 11th. Got a woman who's a personal hero of mine, and she really, we owe her so much. She's a former FBI special agent and division counsel, brilliant, brilliant public servant. And she wrote a memo to then FBI Director Robert Mueller, really accusing the FBI of hampering the investigation into one of the hijackers. So I want to go back with you, Colleen Rowley. Your courage, your willingness to step forward and become a whistleblower made you one of Time Magazine's Persons of the Year in 2002. And I welcome you to this show. September 11th, 2001. Where were you? How did it impact you? And what prompted you to write this memo?
Well, I was in the legal counsel in the Minneapolis office when agents here discovered, only because flight instructors, whistleblower flight instructors, two separate ones called the office and said they had the most suspicious flight student they've ever seen. So these agents who were so astute, one being an INS agent, ran out, did some quick work, tried to do some interviews, and then realized they had a terrorist on their hands and took him into custody because his visa had lapsed. Then the horrible part of the story begins, because they called me that night after they arrested him to see if they could do an emergency search without a warrant. And, of course, if you had watched the O.J. Simpson case, you know that warrantless searches are very frowned on by judges. And so the normal advice is, no, you need to put your probable cause down and seek a warrant. And in this case, because it was suspected that he was operating as an agent of a foreign terrorist group, they had to go through the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. So they did that. These agents were, again, like they knew from the start. They knew the possible criminal violations. I mean, right from the start, they knew this. They quickly reached out to the French. They ran that lead over there. That agent in Paris did the same thing. He knew right from the start. And the French came back and said that Zacharias Moussaoui, this French Moroccan, was recruiting and working for the Chechen terrorist leader Abu Khattab. Now, what the agents didn't know, and I didn't know, and then later officials at FBI headquarters claim they never read, is that in April 2001, 5 months before this, there was a memo saying the Chechen terrorist leader Abu Khattab is closely entwined with Osama bin Laden, and they're going to attack in the United States. Now, again, you go back to Robert Mueller. He wasn't the director at the time. It was a prior director, Louis Free. This memo of April 2001 had Louis Free on it, and it had seven or eight assistant directors by name on it. And, of course, after 9/11, this is, and I'm just pointing to one little area where information was either not read, not even read, or claimed it wasn't read, not shared, because, for instance, in the FBI, once the agents tried to ask for an emergency search, it wasn't even passed up the chain internally in the FBI, let alone over to the Department of Justice, as it should have been. And then, of course, it was not shared between agencies. We later find out that the CIA had been monitoring these Al-Qaeda operatives for 2 years at least, since their important meeting in Kuala Lumpur, which the CIA had monitored. And they had never shared any of this information with the FBI, even when they knew two of the hijackers had come into California. They never shared the information to the FBI until it was too late. And then the last thing was information was not shared with the public. Now, this isn't my conclusions when they say that the problem was lack of information sharing. vertically, horizontally between agencies, and then finally with the public. That's not my opinion. That's actually the opinion of the official inquiries, including the 9/11 Commission. And they actually concluded that based on all of these facts that they finally learned to what, 2 years, 3 years later, by then it was, of course, too late because they had already used the attacks as justification for, as pretext for launching wars on the Mideast and doing all these other terrible things. But that lack of information sharing was the conclusion of the official inquiries. And they said that 9/11 could have been prevented in at least maybe 10 different ways. Not just the Mousawi case, it along with the Phoenix memo, whereby another agent found that there were terrorist suspects in flight school in Phoenix. And that information was not shared either. And in fact, the same FBI headquarters officials claim they never read that memo. I mean, it's so egregious. And what's even more egregious in this between the pre-9/11 failures, and I've just named a couple, there's many, many more. Besides that, what's so egregious is that the families, the victims in New York City, the family members who now for 20 years have been trying to get this information so that they could file a lawsuit, and they were thwarted, essentially completely thwarted. First, the 9/11 Commission refuses to even look into the evidence of Saudis that were helping the hijackers. And this was already uncovered by the Joint Intelligence Committee. There were 28 pages, but they were blacked out that had Saudi officials, including the Saudi ambassador, helping and funding the hijackers that came into California. And that was all blacked out. And so no one even knew about it for I think it was at least 15 years before they finally released that information. And then it took an act of Congress to pass for the families to be allowed to sue Saudi Arabia. And then Obama vetoed that law that was passed. And so now where we're at after 20 years is the Biden finally has ordered the agencies to try to declassify some of the secret information that has been withheld even from the victims, all for 20 years. And the last part of this is that now the FBI says they've lost key photos, reports, and evidence, or mislaid, or whatever. That's the last thing, is that they can't find some of these key things. Photographs, for instance, of the Saudi officials with the hijackers, etc. So here's, it's really a sad, it's been a beyond sad story that we've had since the attacks. First of all, really sad it wasn't prevented in the first place. And then the exploitation, instead of getting to the truth, instead of actually, you know, Robert Mueller admitting these things from the start and then fixing the problems, some of which is why don't we even have a way that officials can't say they didn't read their memos? We still, as far as I know, 20 years later, officials still say, oh, I never saw that. You know, I don't even think that little problem was fixed. So instead of doing that, then Robert Mueller goes along with Bush and shills for starting war on Iraq. I mean, they actually blamed Iraq for being behind 9/11. Dick Cheney said that Saddam was aligned with Al-Qaeda. There wasn't a shred of evidence of that. In fact, Saddam was an enemy of Al-Qaeda. But they used the trauma of 9/11. And, you know, there's this country western song that I don't know the difference between Iraq and Iran, you know, kind of somebody saying I'm proud I don't know anything about the Mideast, you know, because I just want to go to war on them. You know, that kind of a mentality. But they used the trauma for the shock doctrine is what it is, because it's a shocking thing. And when you lie then afterwards, they got 70% of the American public to believe that Iraq was behind 9/11. And that actually lasted for a few years. People were completely misled. Colin Powell gave a completely false presentation to the UN. Just nothing but lies. And then the truth was buried, you know. The 9/11 Commission buried the truth about the Saudi participation. It's a really, you know, I can hardly repeat how bad this is and how bad the corruption is that led to this 20-year-long, you know, failure that we now see in Afghanistan and the killing of millions of people, really. We killed innocent civilians all over the Mideast, carpet bombed Libya, tried to topple the government of Syria, which, again, I think I've read that there are over 30 million displaced people, refugees. A lot of them then tried to flee to Europe. They drowned it in the Mediterranean. I mean, and then the starvation and the famine that has ensued in Yemen, where we, the United States, is helping Saudi Arabia starve the Yemenis. I mean, it's like I said, you start repeating this, it's like so distressing to even know. I think a lot of people actually don't want to know. It's like, it can't be true. You know, it can't be this bad, but unfortunately it is.
Everybody, we're talking with Colleen Rowley, former FBI special agent and division counsel. She wrote a searing memo to then FBI Director Robert Mueller, just helping, outlining how 9/11 could have been prevented. I'm trying to figure out, and you can help me with this, Colleen Rowley, how it is that this evidence gets suppressed or lost. I mean, Dr. King has been dead 53 years, and we're still getting FBI files on him. They get dropped routinely. This man's been gone 53 years, and somehow or another, these intact files keep coming up on him. Help me with that.
Well, in the old days, actually during my career, the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover started, paper files, because we didn't have computers at the time. So everything was put on index cards, and also these big paper files. So, for instance, the COINTELPRO files, some of which I've reviewed, you know, they stack up from the floor. There were tons of these in the 60s, these COINTELPRO files. And, so that's understandable that it's hard to process all of these paper files. Of course, after about the time I retired in 2004, things were really becoming more and more computerized. So I'm not quite sure now why, maybe because some of the 9/11 files in the Pentagon pent bomb that was called the pent bomb files, they're paper. They begin as paper, and then they're put on the computer. Who knows? When you have a photograph and pieces of hard evidence, they go into a separate system. I don't know. I do know that there's also a lot of lackadaisicalness about some of this, because, you know, the victims and witnesses should be priority. That should be a top priority. But it never was a priority. The priority in the FBI was getting statistics, prosecution statistics. So a lot of times the victims and witnesses were just kept in the dark until Congress forced. There was a law passed in 1983 that actually forced the FBI to be more considerate to victims and witnesses. And even then, that law was even ignored for quite a long time. Again, the priority to make your promotion and for your career, it's to amass, you know, indictments, prosecutions, convictions. That's what counts for agents. And that's how you move up the chain, and, you know, in theory that you become a special agent in charge, so you can go through the revolving door after retirement to, quadruple your salary, and as many of these high-level officials do. So I don't know for sure why all of these things now are lost or mislaid. Hopefully they can find some of them, but I think a lot of it is simply that it wasn't a priority. And going back to how to prevent, you mentioned how to prevent 9/11. That was always a question asked in these debriefings, these official inquiries. I testified to the Senate Judiciary. I was debriefed by the Joint Intelligence Committee and the Inspector General investigation that went on for 2 years and was a 400 or 500 page long report. And they would look at me in disbelief and say, well, there was no way to prevent 9/11. Well, this, again, it's not my opinion, but there were at least 10 different ways, and that was actually the conclusion of the 9/11 Commission. What one big, the easiest way, however, to have prevented the attacks was kind of left out. And again, it's kind of, why was that this left out? One easy way to prevent the 9/11 attacks was simply for the warning to the Federal Aviation Administration that hijackers were trying to get into the cockpit. And this actually had already happened before 9/11. There was a hijacking of an Air India airliner with hundreds of people, passengers, that Al-Qaeda hijackers had got into the cockpit and had diverted, I forget to where, I don't know if it was Afghanistan, it might have been Afghanistan or Pakistan, and then they held them threatening to kill the passengers with a bomb unless they released a prisoner that they were using. So they wanted to have a prisoner released. Now, since this was already known that this was possible, for instance, Israel had already put locks on the door of to get into the cockpit. Israel Airlines had already done that. And in the U.S., there had also been other instances of so-called unruly passengers, maybe crazy passengers or drunk, whatever, that had tried to seek access to a cockpit. I think there was even a freight airliner where someone in the cockpit with a knife had stabbed the pilot. So this wasn't rocket science to have realized this, but that warning to the FAA was watered down. And then also, not only was the warning watered down, but the FAA did not want to tell the airlines that they would have to spend a few hundred dollars in order to put those locks on the cockpit doors. It would have probably cost, I don't know exactly, but I've read one time that it was a few hundred dollars to lock the cockpit doors. Of course, immediately after 9/11, that was done. Well, that was the easiest way right there to have prevented 9/11, is if they had not, if they had warned the FAA and then the FAA had warned the airlines. Again, when the public knows these things, if the public had been warned, they are able themselves to take action. The passengers on the flight over Pennsylvania only had a few minutes of warning that they knew that this that what had happened to the other planes. And that's why they then decided to overcome the hijackers. And unfortunately, they crashed the plane, but they probably saved many lives either in the White House or in Congress by doing so. And all they had was a few minutes of knowledge. The passerbys in the Times Square saw smoke coming from under a car. That's how they uncovered the Times Square bomber. And the underwear bomber and the shoe bomber were both stopped by the passengers on the planes. So you're going to find that it's oftentimes the public who is able to know things, or if they are given information, then they're the ones who are able to prevent the action. It's not the FBI. You know, it's the public. That's why the 9/11 Commission concluded, why do we have this excessive secrecy? We should be sharing information. And, of course, I'm going to unfortunately say that's not happened, especially after WikiLeaks. The government went back to thinking that their whistleblowers were their most serious threat. So they then made everything even more compartmentalized and more secret. Because after Chelsea Manning leaked to information to WikiLeaks, they said, "Oh, we've got to prosecute all of these disloyal, people who are talking about our war crimes. We can't reveal torture programs, massive surveillance, as Edward Snowden, John Kiriakou revealing the torture program, Daniel Hale just recently revealing the drone assassination program that's killing civilians. all of them are put in prison. And so this is what the government went to, excessive secrecy to prevent their secrets covering up their crimes. They went to that mode and more secrecy instead of what we should have had after the commissions, at least, that said, no, we need to share more information with the public. It's just gone opposite.
We've been talking with Colleen Rowley, former FBI special agent, division counsel, who wrote this memo to then FBI director Robert Mueller, exposing some of the FBI's pre-9/11 conduct. I've got about a couple of minutes before we go. What is our takeaway? I mean, going forward, where are we? What should we do?
The public does what I just said, sharing information with the public. The public has to now insist, just as those poor 9/11 victim families, they have these losses that have really led them to persevere for 20 years. You know, the public isn't like that. Part of it is because, you know, if you don't have a personal loss, you know, the killing of the millions of people, innocent civilians in the Mideast, hundreds, nearly 1,000 Guantanamo detainees that turned out to be innocent, the torture program, all of these terrible abuses that were all enabled by the trauma of 9/11. Well, a lot of Americans don't really care so much because it didn't affect them personally. I find now I'm in a group called the Eisenhower Media Network, and a lot of them are poor are American soldiers who were fighting in Afghanistan or Iraq. And, of course, a lot of them came back with, of course, debilitating injuries and PTSD, suicidal, et cetera. I'm in this group founded kind of by Danny Shorson, retired major, former West Point historian, Danny Shorson. And so you find they care. So there are groups of people who care about fixing these problems after 20 years. But a lot of Americans are very apathetic, and they let these national security advisors tell them what to think. They'll make up that now we have to double down on war. In fact, they are doing that right now. They're telling Biden that he should never have ended the war in Afghanistan. So, you know, there's got to be a pushback. There's got to be people that say, well, no, he was right after 20 years. This was a complete failure. Even the Afghanistan papers showed it was a complete failure. However, the people in power in Washington, D.C. are going to, quote, they like to make their own reality, which means they can form public opinion, manufacture consent for even further wars and further illegal program abuses, etc. And I think this is where the people really have to get wise now. We're all suffering some blowback here, even though some of it's invisible. There's all kinds of terrible consequences that are coming back from these wars, not to mention the trillions of dollars that have been wasted where they could have been spent on infrastructure and education and working to fix climate change, all these things that the money could have gone for. No, it went up in bombs. 20-some trillion dollars over the last 20 years, maybe more than that, has gone up in bombs, just up in smoke, which actually has hurt the climate even worse. It's very sad. And unless people can understand this truth and these facts, instead of being misled, yes, by people who are essentially war profiteers, that's what they're doing. They're profiting off of this horrible system.
Mm-hmm. Colleen Rowley, everybody. Thank you for your service. FBI, yes, former FBI special agent, division counsel, I've got to have you back because you have to walk us through some more of this mischief. Thank you for getting the word out first. Thank you. Colleen Rowley, everybody. Colleen Rowley. We're going to talk about this new documentary, 9/11's Unsettled Dust, the cancer, the sickness that frontline workers and New Yorkers and people all around are experiencing as a result of 9/11. Back in just a minute.
This is the Santita Jackson Show.
There was substantial data available prior to the event that would indicate issues of concern with the collapse of the Twin Towers. One of those was the, widely known and widely documented and widely advertised heavy use of asbestos during the construction of the World Trade Center project. So the figure that is in widespread circulation and uncontested is that there were 400 tons of asbestos used in sprayed on fireproofing material in the Trade Center construction. That figure excludes probable additional asbestos used in pipe insulation and other applications. So there's a huge amount. I think it's safe to say that whatever was in the World Trade Center was released into the general environment. Nothing disappeared.
Santita Jackson Show, WCPT 820, the nation's largest progressive talk radio station, and AM 950 Radio, Minneapolis, St. Paul. We've just been talking with former FBI Special Agent Colleen Rowley, the whistleblower, one of Time Magazine's 2002 Persons of the Year because of her courage in stepping forward. And so we've got a tremendous panel who are continuing to step forward to let us know what happened on 9/11. Indeed, it's 20 years tomorrow since that day. That our lives changed. We never saw things the same way, certainly in the United States, although to be fair, sadly, a 9/11 happens somewhere in the world all the time. When will we learn? When will we learn that peace is the way, everybody? So let's talk about that today. Let's talk about what happened. What did we know then? What do we know now? Because a lot of people died that day and have continued to die on days subsequent to that. Let's talk about this new documentary, 9/11's Unsettled Dust. Those fires burned for more than 100 days, everybody. Unsettled Dust, 9/11's Unsettled Dust. You will be shocked at the number of people who developed cancer, who died, who are fighting for compensation, frontline workers, people who lived in the area, people in Park Slope in Brooklyn, which is on the other side of the bridge. There's just so much to talk about, and no part of that area was untouched by all of this asbestos that was used in the construction of the World Trade Center. So let's talk about that today, everybody. Call me at 773-763-WCPT, 773-763-9278, 773-763-WCPT. Of course, you can text me at that number. GWC Injury Lawyers gives you the opportunity to do that. But I want to bring on this magnificent panel who are going to help us to really tease all of this, suss all of this out. We've got one of the volunteers, many New Yorkers. Were so devastated, and I was a New Yorker at the time, that you went down, you were looking for something to do. And one of the brave volunteers who went to help the frontline workers, who went to help the people, who just went to help, Rhonda Villamia. You can see her in this wonderful documentary, 9/11's Unsettled Dust. We've got one of the heroes of our environmental movement. Indeed, he's the director of environmental law, of the Environmental Law and Justice Project. And attorney Joel Kupferman, and our filmmaker, Lisa Katzman, producer-editor of 9/11's Unsettled Dust. Thank you so much for your work. Thank you for your service, everybody. Lisa Katzman, 9/11's Unsettled Dust. What is it about, and what made you make it?
Well, the way that we understand 9/11 is that it was the gravest attack on American soil. But it was also an unprecedented environmental disaster. And this is something that many people, many Americans, don't fully grasp. People in New York grasp it, particularly people that live in downtown Manhattan and who worked at Ground Zero. So that was the reason that I made the film, was to really show what happened and what happened locally and what the continuing ramifications are. The film looks at the, in detail at the environmental degradation that occurred when the towers collapsed and in the aftermath. And it also looks at a very orchestrated effort to conceal exactly what was released into the atmosphere. In addition to asbestos, there was benzene, dioxin, PCBs, about 200 contaminants were released into the atmosphere. So the first part of the film introduces a number of people, including Joel Kupferman, who did his own independent testing because he was very suspicious of the reports that were coming out of both city government in New York and from the EPA. And so he took it upon himself to do independent testing, which was grossly at variance with the reports that were coming out. And Joel can talk about that in a moment. And so once the film establishes that, horror of what exactly was going on, it shows that a lawsuit developed on the part of downtown workers and residents that they were the plaintiffs in the suit. It was called Benzman v. Whitman. And it was a lawsuit that sued both the EPA and Whitman. And Joel was an advisor to that suit, which he can speak about in detail. And what we come to see is that this lawsuit actually was upheld. I mean, the finding was that Whitman had intentionally, she was the EPA director at the time, Christy Todd Whitman, and she had intentionally misled the public. She had made statements that said, the air is safe and that she was going to take care of everybody. And it was very clear that that was not the case. Unfortunately, the lawsuit was overturned. So what we see from this is that the courts really did not support the rights of citizens to be protected by the Fifth Amendment, which guarantees the protection of life, liberty, and property. And so there were no repercussions, neither for the EPA nor for Whitman. And an inspector general report came out of the EPA that verified all of these findings and that showed that, that she had really done some egregious things, but nothing really ever came of that. So the film is really looking at the failure of the system, both the government, both the government and of the courts, to really uphold the rights of citizens. And so this, is something that in my view, sets the stage for a whole new chapter of American history where we see less and less accountability in these environmental situations, these environmental disasters like the BP oil spill or what happened in Flint, Michigan. And I would even extend that to, the situation around the government's inability to provide proper protective care during the pandemic. Mm-hmm.
Masks.
The last part, no masks. And
for frontline workers at hospitals. I'm like, how does that work?
Precisely, yeah. And we know that thousands of those frontline workers in hospitals died largely because they didn't have proper protective equipment, had to reuse their masks, had to spray them down, even when the CDC says, no, that's really inappropriate. Those masks should only be worn for 8 hours. But I digress. The final part of the film, really, I'd say the last half of the film, is devoted to the fight, the struggle that was waged by 9/11 first responders and also by area residents and others to fight for a health bill that was named for the first person who died from 9/11 related illnesses, the first known person to die. His name was James Zadroga, and the bill is called the James Zadroga 9/11 Health and Compensation Act. So that fight really started about 4 or 5 years after 9/11, but it built into a very big grassroots campaign that was spearheaded by a man named John Thiel, who was a dynamo. And in 2010, finally, the bill was passed, and it took a lot of effort. Rhonda was one of the people that were part of that effort, and made numerous trips to Washington, D.C. to persuade very reluctant members of Congress, you know, all of whom it happened were Republicans who were resistant to passing the bill for budgetary reasons. You know, they felt that some of them thought that the bill was an entitlement. So while they were touting the heroism of the people that worked at Ground Zero, they were refusing to actually take an interest in their health care. And these were people that by this time, by 2010, had developed debilitating illnesses, cancers, and many other things. Many had died by this time, and many more have died since then. So the film documents all of that, and it shows the second part of that battle, which was waged in 2015, because the bill needed to be renewed. It had only been passed for 5 years. So, you know, the film is it's a heavy subject, but I think that, and I hope you agree, that there is something really sort of, you know, I would say uplifting in the spirit of the people that fought. Mm-hmm. And that,
well, you see them fighting
together at Ground Zero. Yeah.
I mean, you show them fighting and winning incrementally, but winning. And I don't know if it's a, I don't know if you took a digression as much as you made a progression, because subsequent to 2001, we did have Flint. And we have Flints all over the country. We have a lead,
right.
We have a leaded water that people are drinking all over the United States.
That's
we have
right.
cancer alleys all over the United States.
That's right.
We have people who worked in the hospitals cleaning in the hospitals. This, because we forget about people who clean. These are the people who are necessary, but we overlook them. They couldn't get masks. Doctors mm-hmm. could get masks. They didn't get enough. Nurses could get masks. LPNs. This just happened, right? So, I don't think you're going. I don't think you're going too far off track here when you say, "Wait a minute," because you kept giving us examples. Because this is really like corporatism run amok. Let me ask you this before I go to Attorney Kupferman, Lisa Katzman, because you one of the things that I appreciate about 9/11's unsettled dust. And it's going to be on public television in New York, but we need to get it all over the country. We really do, and we need to request it from our public television stations. There was a lot of asbestos in the World Trade Centers. You pulled up that fact. Please help us to understand that, because it was built in, it was like baked in the cake, if you will.
Yes, and I think that Joel is the person who can speak to that. This is really his expertise. And
Joel,
as I said, he was the one that really revealed, you know, that there was much more than we were being told at the time.
Absolutely, because I have to tell you, just watching the explosion, you know, it looked like this was going to be a mess, and maybe I'm just overthinking. Attorney Joel Kupferman, Environmental Law and Justice Project Director. Tell us, the asbestos, if you get asbestos in your floor, you have to move out of your apartment or your house. The World Trade Center had a lot of asbestos.
You have to move out of your house, but unfortunately, if you get it in your lungs, it's almost impossible to get out of your lungs. Hmm. And that's one thing we've learned. And what's also ironic is that all of these chemicals, including asbestos, for a while were considered to be wonder chemicals. As a matter of fact, we stumbled across an ad put out by the, I believe, the Port Authority and the people that built the building that said, you know, don't worry if there's a problem, an explosion or whatever at the World Trade Center. We got you covered because we're using asbestos to stop fires. So they actually promoted the use of asbestos that was there. And we knew from the records also that up until like the 50th floor, they were using it. There was lawsuits against it to stop the use of it. And they didn't remove it from the 50th floors. So you're totally right. When we saw those pictures, it's important to note that your eyes and your nose are sometimes the better guides than hired scientists telling you that there's no problem. So we had pulverized asbestos, and what also turned out with those list of 100 chemicals, it wasn't just the chemicals that were bad. It was the silica alone. It was the particularized materials that just became dust that went with such force out of that area all the way to Brooklyn, to Queens and the like, and settled all over. And yet we were told over and over again that there was no problem. We first really got concerned when the DEC, the local state agency, said the air report said that the air is clean, there's nothing to worry about. And as you said before, just with your own eyes, I said, this can't be. This, you know, we've dealt with cases, with smaller cases, where people have gotten ill, people working at the Brooklyn Navy Yard and the like. And so what we did is we foiled the state, the city, and the feds asking for the documents and saying, tell us, what's the proof here? And we got back their reports that showed that they knew what was there. We also knew that that dust was not only pulverized, that traveled, for a long, long, distance.
That's unbelievable. And,
right.
How much asbestos was in the building?
It was thousands of pounds. They used it, on every floor. They used it to cover, it's basically a flame retardant. They used it, to cover the steel beams going up. So it was that. And then we also knew there was a whole litany of other chemicals there. The amount of lead that was just in the computers alone, was horrible. So there's just a list of chemicals. And the amazing thing also is the feds, the state, and the city kept on saying they didn't know. And all of this information was there, was even on file. We filed for a report put together by a company called Toxic Targeting that listed all those chemicals that were there, that listed the thousands of pounds of lead and everything else. And this is public record. Okay.
Right. And there was the person that put that together did it before the event, and it was already known. Everything that was in those buildings was already known, as Joel is saying. So, yeah.
This is just please continue. Yes.
So, part of it was knowing it was there. And the arguments all the time when there's asbestos somewhere, they tell us, don't worry, it's not exposed. The child living in the building when they're doing the renovation, they're covering it up and it's being removed or the tiles are covered. So that's, a valid excuse. But here they can't, that went to the wind, literally to the wind, that it was just pulverized and then exposed to everybody, with such force that it went into other people's buildings and the like. And that was the problem that they kept on denying on how far this stuff went. And we, in the beginning, EPA, it wasn't just Christy Todd Whitman, it was local people that some of them were good. And they told us that, that the dust travels into people's apartments, whether the windows are closed or not. So we got that statement from the local EPA. And then we found out that they were writing, recommending that people do not clean up their own apartments, that it's illegal for people to touch asbestos, to not hire fully trained people. That letter was basically edited and tweaked by the White House, the Council on Environmental Quality, a guy named James Connaughton, and they just worded the word not. They just added not a little bit that it's okay to go into your apartment and clean up. So the worst thing about the asbestos is that they knew that it was dangerous. The laws knew it was dangerous, and yet they bothered. They didn't bother. They actually went out of their way to tell people to go to their apartments and clean up, and put basically everyone into the zone of danger. And that was the basis of the lawsuit.
And to go back,
they told people they could
work, sweep
it up in their apartments, and if there's a lot of it, they should wear long pants.
Everybody.
That was the New York Health Department that gave that advice. And that was something that Jerry Nadler, Congressman Nadler, talks about in the film, that he ranted and railed against and tried to get the health department to change that very dangerous advisory, and they wouldn't do it.
Well, you know what? Let's hear Let's hear from Congressman Nadler right now before we go to break. Paul, let's cue that up.
After the third day, we knew there was nobody alive there anymore. It was simply a cleanup operation. And from that point on, certainly, if possible from earlier, but certainly from that point on, there was no excuse whatsoever for anybody working or being permitted to work on the site or near the site without using proper respiratory equipment. By proper respiratory equipment, I don't mean the gauze masks, which made things worse, if anything. But I mean real respirators, even if they have to be changed every 20, 25 minutes, even if they're uncomfortable. At the Pentagon, they enforce the OSHA laws, the Occupational Safety and Health laws, which call in that kind of an environment for use of respirators for protection. Now, the environment was nowhere near as degraded at the Pentagon as it was in New York. Nonetheless, they did not permit anybody to work there without a respirator. Here, no one should have been permitted to work there without respirators. In fact, there was a memo we saw at some point in the Giuliani administration talking about how we have to enforce the OSHA laws, and obviously a decision was made, presumably by someone in the Giuliani administration and okayed by the federal government, to ignore the OSHA laws. Almost everything that was done from that point was illegal.
What do you think about what you heard, everybody? The higher-ups at the EPA knew that this was a dangerous, dangerous place for people to be, and yet they encouraged everyone to go into their apartments to clean up. They encouraged people to go back to work. If you remember, people were back at work within days in that area. They were back at work. What do you think about that? I want you to call me. Call us at 773-763-9278, 773-763-WCPT. Of course, we're talking with Lisa Katzman, the producer and editor of this magnificent documentary, 9/11's Unsettled Dust. There is so much that is unsettled with 9/11. 20 years later, we have people who are dealing with cancer right now as a result of 9/11, as a result of going to work, as a result of living in that area. I want you to talk to Attorney Joel Kupferman, the director of the Environmental Law and Justice Project. And we're going to hear from you, Rhonda Villamia. You exposed yourself because you just wanted to help your fellow New Yorkers, your fellow human beings. Let's talk about this on the Santita Jackson Show as we remember 9/11, as we figure out what we can do about it today, 20 years later, back in just a minute on the Santita Jackson Show.
This is the Santita Jackson Show.
People told us, I'm not allowed to wear a respirator because there are cameras around and they don't want the optics of me wearing a respirator down here cleaning up.
Everyone came. Everyone who was affected came. There were responders. There were area workers. There were many, many residents and tenants association leaders. And there were scientists also who were bringing their information.
Christy Todd Whitman, the head of EPA, who was telling the people the air is safe to breathe, owned $250,000 in stock from Citigroup. And her husband worked for Citigroup. Travelers Insurance Company had insurance policies such that if the air wasn't safe to breathe, it could cost Travelers Insurance $500 million, $1 billion in claims. Well, guess who owns Travelers Insurance? Citigroup! And that's how the insurance company saved billions of dollars by Christy Todd Whitman's lie.
Wow. Welcome back to the Santita Jackson Show, special September 11th edition, although it's September 10th. It's the 20th anniversary of the attacks at the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, the heroes who sacrificed their lives on that plane coming out of Boston, going, they just drove it into the ground in Pennsylvania. They said, you will not get to our Capitol. You won't get to the White House. That won't happen. I want you to call me or text me at 773-763-WCPT. But we're talking right now about this incredible documentary, All My Morning Stars, I want you to like and share. And please go to the podcast of this show, which will be up about an hour after the show on WCPT820.com/Santita so that you can hear this show without commercials. We're talking with Lisa Katzman, producer, editor of 9/11's Unsettled Dust. And we're going to hear from Rhonda Villamia, who was a volunteer, many New Yorkers, not everybody, but many people went down to be helpful at Ground Zero, and she's one of those persons, a true heroine. And Attorney Joel Kupferman, the director of the Environmental Law and Justice Project, you were making some tremendous points during the break when we were on Facebook Live. Talk to us. You said there are a lot of vulnerable people. You have a lot of housing projects, public housing, that's in that area between Manhattan and Brooklyn, as the dust continued to fall. Talk to us. Who was impacted by all of this dust and all of these chemicals that people had to breathe in, Attorney Kupferman?
Well, you're totally right about the public housing projects and people in Chinatown. And we just have to also raise the question how they arbitrarily drew the line afterwards of who gets protected and who doesn't get protected to health services. That's the question we have to ask all the time. The Smith houses was the one closest to the 9/11 towers. They got hit. I got a call from a Center for Disabled in New York saying our clients were living there and we haven't heard from. Please go check that out. We went to the housing complex. No one from the city, the state, or the feds even checked to see if they were alive. People were so frail, they couldn't even close the windows or remove the blankets or the sheets from their beds that were dust covered. We had to force the city and the feds to recognize that there's people here, whether public housing or not. They're entitled to equal protection of the law and even, you know, the city's concern. And these buildings were in the shadows of police headquarters. So after 9/11, we had a whole push of finding terrorists, but we couldn't find the dust or the people, you know, that were definitely suffering from the dust, you know, just not more than a few blocks away. So there's a whole slew of people that were neglected. The health department refused to go out and to check and to even test. And then it's not just the public housing residents. We ended up getting hired by the Firefighters Association, the UFA, because they didn't trust the fact that they were being told that the air was clean. They also discovered when they drove their fire trucks, all those guys that were down there, and the fire trucks are down by the World Trade Center, they hit a bump and dust would come down from the roofs of their fire trucks. And they said, this is not right. Right. Mm-hmm. So we went and we tested the trucks and we found high levels of asbestos, up to 5%. 1% is the cutoff level. And we found fiberglass, which is really important because that caused all of the irritants that people's World Trade Center caused. That they try to just basically discount that it was a temporary cause. But fiberglass alone is likely to be a carcinogen and which caused a lot of problems. And the EPA and the city health department's response was, why are you worried, Mr. Kupferman and others? It's likely to be a carcinogen. And they didn't say it's, a carcinogen yet. So it was this constant systematic underassessment and discounting that got a lot of people ill, unprotected, and to this day, you know, in bad condition.
What was the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, headed by former governor of New Jersey, Christine Todd Whitman, as we just heard, her husband had substantial investment in Citigroup. I mean, that was his employer, all of that. What was the EPA's role in all of this, Attorney Kupferman? Because I just remember her, she kept saying, it's safe. Everybody can go back to work, it's safe.
Huh? It's safe.
I mean, this is just days after.
It was days after, exactly. And that's, as the Judge Batt said, with her statement that the air is safe is an egregious statement because it brought back people into the zone of danger, okay? There's a legal principle that you don't have you don't have to tell someone that's in danger that you're going to help them or not, but you can tell them false information or you're going to help. So it was her, the air is safe, got people not just to come back, but also gave this green light to the city and the state not to do their actions, not for the local EPA people who wanted to tell everyone that, you know, the air was bad. They got overruled, okay? And I'm sitting in front of me with a letter to October 5th, 2001, written to the Department of Health from the Chief of Response and Prevention from EPA, saying that we have plenty of problems at the World Trade Center, that building materials from the destroyed buildings, primarily asbestos, hazardous materials were stored in buildings, refrigerants, hazardous waste, glycerin, and products of combustion are there, telling the health department there is definitely a problem. And the health department didn't do anything. They didn't go out and test. And it was Christy Todd Whitman that overruled her local, her people. So getting back to the court case, the judge found that this is egregious, that she known or should have known. And as we got more documents to show that she definitely knew. Unfortunately, the Court of Appeals, in their non-wisdom, decided to overturn it and said that she might not have known or she didn't have the intent to hurt people. Okay? That was their standard. And also they said that she had to follow two laws or two goals, and one was to protect the people and the environment, and the other is to get the economy back going. That was a policy. So the Second Court of Appeals basically said that Wall Street was more important than the people in Lower Manhattan. That was her past. That was overcoming Batts District Court's egregious label. And which also begs the decision is that even following that, if the U.S. was so interested in reviving the economy, how did they send back all those Wall Street workers back to Wall Street, where they knew also that was dangerous, filled with the same World Trade Center dust that went into the public housing areas? So it wasn't even a smart move in terms of conflicting interests, because it just showed that they were so short-sighted that put the whole economy in a tailspin that's actually costing billions and billions of dollars in recovery.
We're talking with Attorney
Wall Street yes. reopened on the 17th.
Did she not get pressure? She said she got pressure from the White House, right?
Yes. It was really what Bush wanted. They wanted to reopen Wall Street. They were terrified, of some kind of financial collapse if it didn't open. And so, that was what drove everything. But, she could have done differently. I mean, and that is really one of the central points that I try to bring out in the film, that, even though the court, as Joel was just describing, the Second Circuit overturned the initial decision that found that she had intentionally misled people, the overturning of the case on the basis that she had conflicting demands, that she was being told by her superiors to get to open Wall Street. But as the director of EPA, it is her obligation to protect the health and the welfare of American citizens. That conflict and the fact that the court decided that because she had a conflict, what she did not shock the conscience, which is really the bar that needs to be, that they have to meet in order to really determine whether or not legally, whether or not what she did was inappropriate. By making that decision, the court really gave a free pass. And, as somebody in the film, Kimberly Flynn, another environmental activist, points out, that then becomes, has been established as a precedent, that the outcome of this lawsuit, Benzman versus Whitman and the EPA, really allows governmental agencies and officials to lie in the aftermath of environmental disasters, because they can claim, I was following orders. And we really know since the end of the Second World War, when Nazi war criminals used that defense for, justifying their own heinous actions, that the Nuremberg trial, showed, or the judges in that trial, their ruling was that if a moral choice is possible in a situation, that the person really needs to not follow orders, and that the moral choice is really takes precedence, and that in this case, Whitman had the agency. She could have done that. She could have followed her own conscience, and she could have said, I can't do this. She could have quit. You know, that's what's really needed in a situation like that when so much is at stake. But
Absolutely.
She chose not to, you know. And so that is really one of the points that the film tries to bring up, you know, that it's that there's something very dangerous and ominous about the decision that was made by the courts.
Absolutely. I mean, Dr. King told us that you have an obligation, a moral obligation to break, to challenge and break unjust
right.
laws because they are unjust. Let me go to Rhonda Villamia because you volunteered. I mean, how does it make you feel knowing that you volunteered when the higher-ups had all of this information about how dangerous it was to be down there? Why did you go, and how does this make you feel a day later, 10 years later, 20 years later? Talk to us, Rhonda Villamia.
Well, at the time, I think I believe I can speak for most of the volunteers. We basically went there to help. We were trying to do whatever we could to help in whatever way we could. I initially was a spontaneous volunteer within those first 2 weeks, so meaning that I was not affiliated with any of the volunteer agencies. I basically was along the West Side Highway between Canal Street and Chambers, and there were different supply stations along the way that we were manning. And then I joined the Red Cross initially and was on the initial shift for the time they were open till they closed would be the respite they had on St. John's University that's on the corner of Murray. I will say that my recollection when we did they give you a little training before you start on your first shift, and they did give us paper masks. I do remember that, paper masks. But other than that, nothing else. I mean, there was no instruction. We just basically were there. I don't honestly recall wearing a mask other than that initial shift that we were given that mask with the Red Cross. After that, it wasn't even a thought. It wasn't even a thought. And yes, I mean, I started to have within a month of being there in October, I started to have the sinusitis and the ground zero cough. And I actually to this day have the ground zero cough because when I laugh hard, I start coughing. And it's been all of these years. And we feel betrayed. Mm-hmm. I feel betrayed that this information was so skewed. And as I said, it didn't even really cross my mind while I was down there. It didn't even cross my mind while I was down there. And it's interestingly, last night I was speaking with Lisa and hadn't thought about this till last night that we were speaking. And I actually had a friend, a former colleague I used to teach, and her husband had cancer, and she knew that I was, you know, volunteering down there. She was concerned about him having to go to his appointments and with the air quality being what it was. And she asked if I could possibly get one of the respirators for him. And I was able to do that, and I gave it to them. But I honestly didn't even think of, well, you know, maybe I should get one for me. None of the volunteers were wearing this apparatus. It was mostly the workers, the responders that came into the tent or to St. John's that were outside working. But we didn't have anything to use there. And I mean, I recall part of the protocol to come into the tent was decontaminating the boots, supposedly, before the workers came in. And the decontamination was basically water, you know, a hose, water, washing them off. I don't know to what degree that was effective and what was tracked inside to the rugs or whatever may have been in there that, you know, would have marinated there a little bit, aside from everything else that was going on outside. But yes, I mean, That's my recollection and my thought.
Well, how is your health now?
I have about 9 certified conditions, mostly aerodigestive, upper respiratory, musculoskeletal, PTSD. I've tried, for the most part, I'm a proponent of more holistic options to treat conditions, and so I had been having acupuncture for these past number of years, which actually, this might be a subject for another show, was actually stopped by the program. The coverage was stopped. Terminated, basically. I can't
by your insurance.
By the World Trade Center Health Program.
Let me ask you this: do you have access to any of these funds? You know, because you have groups that you know we are watching firefighters and frontline workers have access. Not as they don't get as much money as they need, as much as they should. But do you have access to any of those funds?
Are you talking about the victim compensation fund?
Victims compensation funds.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. That fund was made available to us with the passing of the Zadroga Act. So that is something that we do have available, that we have had available. But my, you know, my point is at this point, I up until now have been able to manage my conditions, and in fact, because of the alternate therapeutic modalities that I've been using, have even been able to not have to see as many specialists as I was seeing when I was living in New York. I'm down in Florida now, in my hometown, and had to basically transfer into the National Responder Program. That's covering us outside of the New York metropolitan area.
Rhonda Villamia, one of the volunteers at Ground Zero. And as you can hear, she's got health challenges today. And so many, I was reading a story about a woman out of Middletown, Connecticut. She's struggling with breast cancer. Because she was in the area. I mean, we just keep on hearing Middletown that she is talking about this. She is Lee Kalmar. She said, they took out all my lymph nodes. I had chemo. I had radiation. I lost all my hair. She's describing her battle with breast cancer because she was off on September 11th, but she had to go back to work. And there you have it. I'm just praying for you. And you can certainly come back to the show to talk about these other treatments, because certainly people need to have access to as many options, healthcare options, as they can. And I do believe in these naturopathic remedies, because at one time, you know, our grandparents and so forth, that's all that they had. And they lived long and well. Let me go to you, Attorney Kupferman. I only have a few more minutes here. I want to give a couple of minutes to you and then a couple of minutes to Ms. Katzman. What is our takeaway? Renee Criswell says this: isn't this just like the messages going on now regarding the safety of people going back to schools across the country at full capacity? And isn't it the same as going to into the workplace and play space without masks? She is a teacher. Have we learned anything, Attorney Kupferman?
No, I think, unfortunately, the lessons learned have been very, very limited. We're dealing with teachers now in New York and elsewhere that are being forced to go back into classrooms where they're being told that an open window is enough, and we definitely know it's not enough. And people are also scared to speak out. And I think it's important that we don't have access to public health care either. And it's disasters, and 9/11 really pointed out how bad it is, and COVID has also showed it's a disparate impact. It's people of color and poor people that are getting the short end of the stick that are not getting the right protection. So I think it's very important to see what we learned. And also we learned in New York that you can't withhold information in the nursing homes and the like without having, you know, major after effects. So I think the government agencies know people have a right to know and actually participate in their own protection. So I think it's really important that people come forward and demand just much more clarity and also openness and proper protections, especially the workplace in the COVID situation.
Oh, transparency. It's like 20 years later, Lisa Katzman, a producer, editor of 9/11's Unsettled Dust. You have got to see this documentary, everybody. 9/11's Unsettled Dust. If you're living in the New York area, you can catch it in the tri-state area. You'll be able to see it on public television. But maybe you need to try and tap into that system. You don't want to miss that. I've got just got under 2 minutes, Lisa Katzman. What is our takeaway? What do you want us to take away from all of this?
Well, I agree with everything that Joel just said about the importance of that people have the right to know and that they need to assert the right to know, and that what I hope from watching this film that people understand that they have every reason to be skeptical about what they might hear in the aftermath of the disaster, and that they should demand answers and proofs and organize exactly in the way that people did to pass the health bills. But it shouldn't have to get to that. You know, it shouldn't come to the point where those things are needed as the result of a dereliction of duty on the part of the government at every level during a disaster. So what we really need is much more accountability, and that the environmental regulations that are on the books need to be enforced. I mean, had those things been done, had Ground Zero been declared a Superfund site or what they call a RCRA site, then certain laws, certain statutes would have been enforced, and there would have been a much stricter adherence, you know, to what was needed, which was the use of respiratory wear, you know, everything that Nadler calls for in that clip. None of that happened. And so that's, I think, you know, the takeaway is that we need our regulatory agencies to do what they need to do. And right now, many of them are captured by interests that really are antagonistic to the mission of those agencies.
Sure,
and that
sure.
needs to stop.
Everybody, you've got to see the... Well, stay right there. You know what? Can you stay with me for a couple minutes on Facebook Live? I just want you to engage the audience just a little bit longer. Rhonda Villamia,
sure.
Thank you for your service. Praying for your continued strength and health, and you have a home on this show to come back and talk about how you are taking care of yourself, how you are increasing your healthfulness. Attorney Joel Kupferman, Director of the Environmental Law and Justice Project, thank you for your work, for this brilliant work you've done. Lisa Katzman, producer and editor of 9/11's Unsettled Debt, thank you. Stay right here on Facebook Live, everybody. God bless you, everybody. God bless you. Please take care. And remember, corporatocracy should not trump democracy. We're in charge here. Act like it, everybody. Stay right here. Have a wonderful weekend. God bless.